You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour, you're going to have to pronounce your name. You just walked in and sat down, and I didn't get it clarified. Yes.
Absolutely. It's Samara.
Samara Selden.
Samara Selden, yep.
Samara, it is wonderful to have you here this morning.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for the quick turnaround. Thanks for being comfortable with the quick turnaround. So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? Ah. What do we need to know to start this conversation and about the life you aspire to live, some of the things you've done or been, the labels you wear? Just what do we need to know who you are?
Absolutely. So I guess a quick kind of overview. I'm 27 years old. I'm originally from Rochester, New York, so about 2 hours from here. I'm an only child, grew up with my parents, loved going hiking, canoeing, camping. We actually came to Ithaca a lot when I was a child. I learned to swim at Robert Truman State Park. So I eventually ended up coming here for college, and then I never left.
That's not an unusual story.
Yeah, absolutely.
although you, yes, well, that's just not an unusual story. Yeah. So what is the quality of life you aspire to have?
That's a good question. And something I've been thinking about a lot is I studied psychology and religious studies as an undergrad at Cornell, and I always kind of assumed that I would figure out at some point during my college education that I would know what I want to do. And yet here I am 5 years after that, and I'm still not really sure what I want to do. But
I'm like 40 years after that.
Exactly. I think it's a constant exploration.
Yeah.
But a thing that I think about a lot is I'm really interested in the human condition and what makes us live happy, fulfilling lives. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I find that I've kind of been approaching that from several different angles.
Sure.
And so in terms of my personal life, that's something that I aspire to achieve. And I think I'm finding ways to kind of go about that. And then in terms of my kind of professional life, that's also an aspect that I'm trying to work into what I want to do career-wise long-term.
Right.
So I guess what does it mean to live a happy, fulfilling life? You could say, and that is also
And we will get there. We will get there.
So
let's take a moment to turn to music. And I think you wanted to begin with "You Make Me Feel Like Dancing."
Yeah.
Okay. So and what was really funny was, you know, you're in your mid-20s, and mm-hmm. this came out when I was in college.
So it's a catchy tune, though.
Yes, it is. It is a very catchy tune. Dog hanging on your lead. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Samara Seldon. Samara, that's a great song. I love to dance. In fact, I will even turn up the music and nobody's around, and I'll find a way to dance, just because it is freeing. It's expressive. You said one of the things that motivates you is how do people discover and live happy and fulfilling lives, and I want to stand that task on its head and say, what about the way you were raised? What about the way you have chosen to live has made that question something that you care to ask? Because that's not a question that people necessarily come to inherently.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess a lot of that, I think back to my childhood, I was lucky. I was raised in a really loving home. My parents, I'm an only child, but my parents played with me a lot. They took me on adventures. So I think part of that is I was exposed to a lot of camping and nature and just the mm-hmm. beauty of the world all around us. And so from a young age, I think I fostered an appreciation for just beauty everywhere in the world.
Sure.
And so that kind of is part of it. And then growing up, I also danced ballet mm-hmm. throughout my whole childhood and up through high school until I came to college. And that's something that I think also I found that not only is it physically, as we were saying, you know, dancing is a really wonderful expressive thing. It's kind of this creative tool. And it also, I think our spoken language is limited sometimes. And so it allowed me kind of another outlet to express myself, for lack of a better term.
Right, right. And yeah.
Yeah. And so a lot of my experiences growing up kind of made me feel very fulfilled and happy in a lot of ways. And yet also we're constantly kind of exploring that and how we can, you know, live more and more, kind of settle into ourselves and right. understand ourselves better. And so I think that's something that I'm also really interested in, how everyone can kind of settle into themselves a little bit more be happy and fulfilled.
Right.
And so I'm not sure if that exactly answered your question, but
I'm going to tell a couple of brief stories.
Absolutely,
in response to what you just said.
Yeah.
So I, you know, when I was a kid, one of the things we'd do is we'd buck bales. We'd put up hay uh-huh. on the farm. And, you know, there's a way when you hold the hay hook and you lift the bale where it's a motion where your body moves in a very fluid way. And even though you may pick up an 80 or 100 pound bale and toss it, it's big work.
Yeah.
It's almost as, I mean, weighs two-thirds or three-quarters as much as I did. And to move that along, you wouldn't hurt yourself because you were aware of your emotional state and your physical state, and you were doing some calculations about how that piece was laying. And I also worked at a grocery store, and you carry groceries for half a mile, and mm-hmm. you learned how to hold your back straight so that it would not damage you, your shoulders wouldn't slump, your posture would help to make you both feel good physically. And the exercise kind of gave you kind of the endorphins that we talked about with another guest.
Yeah.
It kind of gives you a sense of happiness.
Yeah, definitely.
But what I hear in your story is from a very early age, you integrated what I would call intellectual knowledge with emotional knowledge, mm-hmm. and then with visceral, which is sensory based, kind of the kind of the core visceral reaction knowledge, so that they all three work together.
Absolutely, yeah.
A lot of people don't get that.
Yeah.
So, and you were an only child, and your parents, it sounds like they were stretching you in all mm-hmm. of these directions with a sense of balance.
Yeah.
Where did that balance come from for them, or do you know?
That's a good question as well. I'm not sure exactly. I think my mom, it comes from kind of an internal drive. She is very intelligent. She's very motivated to, mm-hmm. she has a million different hobbies. I don't think I'm exaggerating.
Yeah.
And so I think she's constantly just curious about things mm-hmm. and wants to learn new things. And so that when she had me, that's kind of passed on through me, learning, you know, telling stories and exploring new places together. For my father, I think, I'm not sure if it came from his family. He's from a kind of larger family. And so I think his siblings and him, when he was younger, they kind of all explored a lot. And he's also just very curious in terms of I'd say physical exploration. Mm-hmm. He loves to travel. He loves to learn new things in that regard.
And hike in the muck and stuff.
And hike, absolutely. He loves going stomping in the swamps.
Right. And so what birth order? Where was he in the birth order of a large family?
He's the second oldest. So I guess there's only four kids. So it seems big to me because I'm an only child.
He's
so.
Technically in the middle.
Right.
So what are the kinds of questions practically that you work on now?
Yeah. So I guess when you were talking about those kind of three areas of, you're saying like
intellect, emotion, and physical, visceral processing.
It's the intersection of all of those is what I'm really interested in. Uh-huh. And especially that last point, the sensory and visceral, because I think that in this current day and age, I mean, I work a desk job up at Cornell part-time, and then I teach yoga.
Uh-huh.
And I find sometimes I'm sitting at my job, and I'm hardly breathing, and my posture is terrible, and I don't even notice it, because we're so...
Until your mind begins to check out.
Right. Yeah, because we're intellectually stimulated, and we're mentally engaged in a task, and so we forget about our physical body, and mm-hmm. I think that that happens more and more these days with movies and computers and phones, and the way that we interact is...
And progressively over the last 150 years, mm-hmm. as work has become less physical and more cerebral.
Yeah, but I think that we carry so much intelligence in our physical bodies mm-hmm. and emotions in our physical bodies, and when we completely tune out of that, we're losing something. We're losing a little bit of touch with that, and how do we kind of integrate our emotional and physical intelligence with our mental intelligence.
So as you reflect on that, what are you discovering about yourself or about others?
So I guess a big point of discovery for me is I dance ballet, and then I've been practicing yoga for several years. Last year I did a yoga teacher training, and now I've been teaching it. And so for me, yoga has been a way to kind of get deep into mm-hmm. that and kind of foster that mind-body connection, I guess
we can call it.
But I think there's so many different ways to go about that. And so for me, I found that yoga is a really powerful way to do that. But I think, that's the biggest thing for me recently.
And as with so many people, you found something, but you don't want to speak of it. I'm inferring here. Let me just make this inference over the radio, because I think it's something that we live in an age where people find it hard to speak with the full wonder and joy of their experience for fear they will offend somebody because there are other ways.
Right. And I think I'd see that twofold is that is absolutely part of it. And I think on the flip side, there's also, it can happen is that you do become very ingrained in a certain way of thought or a certain practice and believe that's the only way and kind of limit yourself because of that. So I think that's an aspect of it as well.
Right. I want to come back to this notion of integration. Absolutely. Because if you are really experiencing the joy and the wonder and yoga has been like one of the integrating things in my life.
Uh-huh.
You know, and when you say that, it has a power and a weight. It doesn't challenge anybody else's other experience.
Right,
who might
use
running or who might use racquetball or something else to kind of get that that feeling. But what happens, if a person is really honest and they listen to themselves,
mm-hmm.
when it moves from being an honest expression of wonder and joy and extreme happiness, you're going to hear in your voice there's a sound of strain. And a person who's become ideologically committed but not experientially grounded,
mm-hmm.
you hear it in the way they use their language.
Right.
And so I think I think the evidence is there, and what we need to be then is the mirror. It doesn't sound like it makes you as happy as it used to. In terms of being the Buddhist or being the Christian mm-hmm. or being the Jew or being the secularist that you were isn't satisfying you anymore.
Mm.
You need to find where the next fullness or wholeness comes. That's what I'm hearing in terms of the kind of a conversation we're not having as a culture.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's interesting that you brought up religion there, because I think religion is something that in societies, in years past, it's been a huge part of many people, if not most people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a pretty recent phenomenon that we've kind of moved away from religion on a kind of large scale. There's so many, especially younger people, so many people do not identify with a particular religion.
With an institutional religion.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And so I think that religion has its issues, obviously. Everything has its issues. But I think the spiritual aspect of religion and the kind of seeing something larger than yourself and feeling hope and feeling whatever that is, that sense of community, that sense of larger self, is a really valuable part of the human experience.
Right.
And so it's something that I think is sometimes lacking these days. And that's part of the whole living fulfilling lives. How do we kind of fulfill that need for a larger than yourself kind of, I don't know what to call it exactly, but
experience. So, I mean, so when we rejected institutional religion, I'm going to say something that's going to sound outrageous, but I'm saying not so much for you as for the listener.
Sure.
You know, I have never met a person who's not religious. And that's because I want to go back to the Latin root of the word, which is religare, religament. Mm-hmm. When the ligaments are what holds the whole together.
Right.
They're what holds the body together. Our religion is what we do when we're torn apart. So when your life falls apart, it tells me what your religion is. Institutional religion made sure that we got taught at least one set of skills about how to put your life together, how to deal with suffering, and how to discover joy and hope.
Yeah,
that was a task. When we reject institutional religion, we rejected the need to learn systematically how to do that for ourselves, which is what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know today.
Right.
So we're going to need to So when I ask a person, what do you do when your life falls apart? They tell me their religion.
Right.
And they don't necessarily see me answering that question. But if I asked you what religion you are, you might say, I'm not religious, or I'm Jewish, or I'm Christian. But you've lied to me because you haven't told me what you actually do.
Right.
And so it forces us to have a more evidence-based conversation.
I like that. Yeah.
Cool. And then we can go back and we can look at the old institutions, which were tired and worn out, people were kind of did it too long, like you were talking about, you know, lost the wonder, you know. But when you're really doing something that works, you have the wonder.
Yeah.
And then you can challenge the person, you know, this is not feeding you. Do something else.
Right.
And so, but you know, as you know, with your background at Cornell, we don't get to study it that way, which is practical psychology, practical spirituality, practical religion, practical anthropology.
Right. Yeah. And I think from a structural standpoint, it makes sense to break up disciplines in such a way. And yet it is that kind of overlap of everything that is where the good stuff is, or, you know, where the kind of, at least for me, where the really, really interesting questions lie. And
yet
it's challenging to,
Each discipline has its tools.
Absolutely,
and you want to know how to use a lot of different tools, but it's what you can make with them all, not the tool that matters. I mean, we get into what's called goal displacement when we focus on the tool and not on what we make with it.
Yeah, I like that. That's a really cool perspective on it.
So let's cut to music and we'll come back to we'll take a different turn. What should we play next?
Let's do Son of a Preacher Man, since we're at...
Since we're in religious mode.
We're in religious mode. Give us some Aretha.
To my eyes. kiss from me on the sly. Taking time to make time, telling me that he's all of mine. Learning from each other's knowing, looking to see how much we're growing. The only boy who could ever reach me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Samara Selden. So, Samara, I hear that you are getting ready to move to New York City. And so what precipitates that move, and what are you hoping to find and do there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess my main reason for moving is my partner got a really great job offer there. So
you're the trailing partner.
So I'm the trailing partner, and it's also a little bit more than that is. So I came to Ithaca for school, and I've been here for about 5 years afterwards. Mm-hmm. I love this town. It's an amazing mm-hmm. place. I could happily see myself living here forever. At the same time, I feel really comfortable here, and I don't think I'm ready to be so comfortable yet. Uh-huh. And I think it's the type of thing is I think it's good to challenge yourself, and I like to explore new places, see new places, live different lifestyles. I think mm-hmm. it can teach you a lot about yourself and about everything. And so I kind of see this as an opportunity to try something completely new and find a new type of work and live a different style of life for a while. And mm-hmm.
What are some of the things you anticipate trying or anticipate exploring by virtue of the move to New York?
Right. I guess a big part of it is less specific things, but kind of it's an internal reflection of identity, I think is.
So you're going to see how you are in an urban setting.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about a lot because I've never lived in a big city before. I've mm-hmm. never thought of myself as a city person or as, it's not a part of my identity thus far.
Right.
And so it's been interesting trying to sort through, well, what are my values? What are the reasons that I've gravitated towards places like this? And has it just been happenstance? And
right.
how can I make sure that the things that I really value and believe in are still things that I am able to find in New York? And so on one hand, it's exciting. I think there's so many different types of people there, and there's so many different types of communities. And so getting to kind of find my place within a new location is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Do you know where you'll be living?
Roosevelt Island for now, and then Manhattan, mm-hmm. I think.
Okay.
But yeah, I know I'm still learning all the boroughs and getting all that sorted out.
Yeah. And Roosevelt Island is its own kind of interesting community. In fact, there was even a physician who practiced on Roosevelt Island who did all of his patient contacts were within their homes.
Oh, really?
And technically, that is actually a more effective way to practice medicine because it allows you to do diagnosis, which is within the habitat that the person lives, so you can actually see much more clearly what's going on, as long as you have the other equipment for doing the testing and stuff that you need to do for conventional, Western medicine.
Right, you get the full picture, and the person's a little more comfortable in their own home too.
That's right. The levels of anxiety and the comfort with disclosure of stuff that might mm-hmm. not be disclosed if you were in an office. Lots of things have changed. And then there's the tram. I guess the tram. I think the tram still works. So when I moved from Ithaca to New York City in 1981, I was overstimulated so much.
Yeah.
I had to kind of like know when a piece of paper hit the pavement behind me and what was going on in front of me and above me. And I was so, because I didn't know how to trust it.
Yeah.
And coming from rural, kind of a very, mm-hmm. very isolated rural area, and then to college at Cornell, I didn't really know how to relax. It took me 2 years to physically relax in New York City and to get comfortable also with the driving.
Yeah.
Because that was a big, big different thing.
Definitely, yeah. I will not be taking my car, so that is a release on that. But yeah.
Do you anticipate this being a long-term move or a permanent move?
Probably not permanent, but definitely long-term. Mm-hmm. I think I can imagine myself in the next several years. I don't know really what that means, but yeah.
And career-wise, do mm-hmm. you see your life in terms of well, how do you see work?
Yeah.
And the building of remunerative work mm-hmm. into your life.
Yeah. You know, I guess I think it's really important to work, and I think that you contribute to society when you work and you feel fulfilled when you work. At the same time, career has never been the strongest driving force in my life. Uh-huh. And so I have this, it's that thing of I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do for work. And there's sure. so many different directions and areas. And so in terms of work, it's important to me that I find a job that I enjoy doing and mm-hmm. feel like I'm contributing in some way.
Right.
And yet, when I guess I have an image of myself when I'm maybe 40 or 50 of the type of work I want to do, but it's that area from now until then that is kind
of
up in the air.
And do you feel comfortable sharing that image, or is it something that you want to kind of hold tightly?
I can share it. It's a pretty vague image, so.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think I love the idea. It's actually a bit similar, I think, to what you do in terms of group therapy work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I played around for a while with the idea of being a counselor, and I decided I don't think that's exactly the route I want to go. Mm-hmm. And yet, I really like the idea of kind of group healing. And I think I'm really good at creating spaces where people feel comfortable and supported and able to open up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's something I've found in my personal life. And also through teaching yoga, it's the same idea of cultivating mm-hmm. a space where people can kind of explore things in a way that they might not do in their normal day-to-day mindset.
Right.
And so I love the idea of having some kind of group therapy, healing, something practice where I can control the settings of the, make the room and the physical, it's a sensory experience again, making mm-hmm. the sensory experience conducive to positive self-love, I guess. I don't know.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
And I'm going to use conventional anthropological language and conventional religious language.
Mm-hmm.
What you're creating is a ritual space.
Yeah.
And the ritual space and rituals, and for people who kind of reject that language as dated, or mm-hmm. a ritual is a process by which people with certain qualities are able to learn and become different sorts of people with different sorts of skills coming out of that process. So the rituals that get us from infancy to toddlerhood to mm-hmm. from toddlerhood to childhood to adolescence to adulthood, get us from adulthood to old age.
Yeah.
Those ways in which we mark the transitions, and there are thousands of them, and yet sometimes we want a big moment like a graduation or a big moment like a confirmation, where people get to really push to kind of come through. So you can have group, and this is the first time I've ever been on a show where I've kind of noticed that there's a quality or a constellation of characteristics. When you do that kind of work, mm-hmm. you are a guide or a coach. And it's traditionally how within very traditional or pre-modern cultures, how people help them get through to the next phase of life. And so I went to Union Seminary, and now Union has become even more inclusive of global religious practices and whatnot. But one of the tracks in that seminary was psychology and religion,
mm-hmm.
and with that also clinical pastoral education, where people would be training chaplains, but they'd also be training spiritual leaders from all different religious traditions. And so as the supervisor, you would invite the students, and they would go out and they would do their work, and they would come back and reflect on it.
Yeah.
And figure out kind of how they could help people make meaning in ways that they were stuck. And they also for themselves.
Yeah.
And you become a different sort of person mm-hmm. when you come out of that process.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do the station ID again. You pick the next song and we'll announce it. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Samara Selden. What should we play next?
Let's do the Rodriguez song, Crucify Your Mind.
Okay. Here we go. Do you want to say anything about it? Or do you want to say something after it? Or just let it go?
Let it go. It's a great song.
Thank you. Was it a huntsman or a player that made you pay the cost, that now assumes relaxed positions and prostitutes your loss? Were you tortured by your own thirst in those pleasures that you seek, that made you Tom the Curious, that makes you James the Weak? And you claim you got something going, something you call unique. But I've seen your self-pity showing as the tears roll down your cheeks. Soon you know I'll leave ya, and I'll never look behind, 'cause I was born for the purpose that crucifies your mind. So convince your mirror, as you've always done before, giving substance to shadows, giving substance evermore. And you assume you got something to offer, secret shiny in you. But how much of you is repetition that you didn't whisper to him too?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Samara Seldon. And so while the music was, while Crucify Your Mind was playing, we were having a little conversation off air about how the move to New York offers a chance to change habits. And one of the things about people who are deeply integrated into their bodies is that they need to create those habits, probably more than other people, or in a conscious way, because that is such a part of daily life that you're very much aware of. And you said that you were seeing the opportunity of moving to New York City as an opportunity to change your habits.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's kind of exactly what you were saying, is we have these kind of routines, and so much of our day-to-day life is habitual. We don't even realize
we're doing it.
That we're doing it, yeah. And even the way that we get ready for work in the morning, or the way that we cook our meals or whatever, you know, we have these established patterns that unless we actively choose to change them, we don't usually change.
Right.
And so I think the beauty of moving to a new place and starting a new job and having all of these like things that shuffle around in, mm-hmm. in my life right now is it's this opportunity to completely change my day-to-day routine. And when you first move to a place, especially, I think there's the added bonus of nothing is established. There's old habits you can fall into, but for the most part...
Or you can look to recreate them.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, and that's not what you want to do necessarily.
Absolutely, and I think a lot about how important the physical spaces mm-hmm. that we occupy can be. And so having new physical spaces to occupy allows you to set different habits and intentionally, like for me, for example, I would love to get up every morning and do maybe even 20 minutes of yoga and meditation. And yet mm-hmm. this is something that I do a couple times a month, you know,
but it sounds like the morning is the problem.
Yeah, the morning may be the problem. But it's also, I think it's also because I've gotten into a particular habit of, you know, getting up at a certain time, rushing to get to work, mm-hmm. coming home. I have a lot of really wonderful roommates that we cook and we hang out, and sometimes I'll stay up too late and therefore I get up late and right before, you know, so it's this cycle of that. I think you can change your cycle.
Right, right. But it also tells me that you are lived by your life rather than living your life. You put yourself in a situation where you're not choosing as you go along. And you're reacting to it rather than shaping it.
Oh, I suppose that's, yeah.
And there's a sense in the dance of life where sometimes we follow and sometimes we lead.
Right.
And it looks like you're looking for an opportunity to lead in your daily life.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. Yeah.
What I was wondering about is how do you deal with disorientation?
Yeah.
I mean, have there been times in your life that you've found particularly disorienting?
Disorienting,
like the death of a friend or a relative, or the change of a relationship, or the loss, or the discovery of something that just wasn't anticipated.
Yeah. There's definitely a few different instances that come to mind. The death of a friend actually is one that my senior year of college, a friend of mine passed away. I think this was in about February of that year. He had a heart condition, ended up dying. It was obviously awful and really sad, and yet there was a kind of beauty to it in the sense that it made, because I lived in a cooperative living house in college, and so he was a member of this co-op community, and so it kind of brought everyone closer together, and I think made us all appreciate that we don't necessarily have, you know, 50, 60, 70 more years here. We have no idea. And so it kind of fostered this sense of beauty and appreciation for what we have now. But then a few months later, another friend passed away, and it was right before graduation. And so there was something about those two deaths so close together that when my second friend passed away, it was this, you don't necessarily have an infinite amount of time to live, and probably everyone is going to die.
Yeah.
You know, suddenly and awfully. And so it kind of, that was definitely for about a year or two, it was definitely a really challenging time in my life. And it made, in some ways, I felt like I became an adult then. That's kind of when I look back.
So what about it made you become an adult? What was your responses that you would call made you an adult?
Yeah. So I think part of it was just the process of learning how to grieve and how to, because when my first friend passed away, I was very open with grief, and I, you know, just, I cried a lot, and it was just, I processed it. And
did you know about his condition?
I didn't.
But it helped explain why it happened.
And right.
It put it in some context.
Yeah. Yeah. And when my second friend passed away, I didn't deal with it well. I think I cried a little, but I completely shut out, you know, and I kind of just dealt with it by going numb. And so for a while, that was kind of how I dealt with it. And I knew I wasn't dealing with things, but I eventually kind of forced myself to come to terms with that. And I think through that process, I became more of an adult in kind of not facing reality, I don't want to say, but kind of realizing that there's extreme value in allowing yourself to grieve and allowing yourself to work through things and seeing that there is always a balance in things. And even though something really sad and awful, you can lose someone close to you, a friend or a parent or a loved one, but figuring out how they still remain and how you can kind of grow from that experience, at least on a personal level, and kind of, I don't want to say move on, because I think we always keep the people that are lost in us in some way, but yeah.
We hold a memory, and in that memory, even the biology of memory is that we will, our blood pressure, our physical response will change when we are in the presence of their memory.
Yeah, yeah.
To something about the time when we were together.
Yeah.
So it's palpable. It's real. Were you closer to the second friend who died?
You know, I wasn't. And both of them were friends that, because it was kind of, so this cooperative living house, both were kind of members of that cooperative living house community. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't my best friends, but they were peripherally people that I'd spent a lot of time with. And I think that is actually part of, kind of sparked my interest in also trying to figure out how to help other people heal too, because I was grieving, but I think there are a lot of people that were closer to the people that had died. And so to see them suffering, but feel like, how do you, is it even my place to help someone? And how do you help someone? Is this helping even the right word in this situation? And so that's an area that I think, I don't know, it made me think a lot about how do we heal from situations like that? And how do you properly grieve? And how do you, you know,
not properly. That's
that's not the right word.
No,
yeah.
no. But I mean, yeah. How do you be with what you are?
Right.
And I think when you tell the story, what I wonder about is that the first death interrupted your life, but it interrupted it in a way that made sense with how you understand the world to be.
Yeah.
And the second death was just one too many. And when there's just one too many, the tendency is to shut down.
Right.
The tendency is to push it away.
Yeah.
Because it's not, it's, and it shows that on a, you had intellectually accepted death in the earlier one, but it hadn't, it didn't live in your life.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it has to, and for it to live in your life means that you know what it is to look at a person and to know what it is to look at their skeleton at the same time or their corpse without having either image control you.
Yeah.
And there are very few, and choosing that as a skill to learn sounds really odd in this world.
Definitely. Yeah.
But it allows us to be with people and not control them.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, creating space where the other person can die allows that person to be free.
Yeah.
And for you to still love them.
And it's inevitable that everyone will die at some point, so it's that strange thing of facing, when do you choose to acknowledge that, and when do you,
Right, and it's... acknowledging the fact of a death is different than living in the reality of death.
Or physically experiencing the loss of someone.
Or physically, But living within the reality of death means that everything I see and know will be gone.
Yeah.
To that person or to me. And I still live and I still engage. Now, when that one is gone, then you have the very specific shadow piece. When I talk with people about where there's a spouse from a long marriage or a long relationship, it's like somebody took an axe and hacked off one side of your body, and you can watch the blood pulse out because that's no longer there. And eventually you rediscover that you have a wholeness, that you didn't exactly lose that, but physically, viscerally, that's what it can feel like for a lot of people. And the anger at the spouse for dying, as well as the love for having had them, are all real simultaneously. When you're reacting to something specific, it's a drama.
Yeah.
But when you're living with the awareness, it's kind of a choice to be at peace. And I think in terms of and happiness, I think you can see wonder.
Yeah.
In it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm talking too much.
That's all right. It's very interesting.
Let's cut to music, and then I want to come back and talk to you about what you do for self-care.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
So what should we play the Ricky Skaggs piece?
Let's do that.
Okay,
yeah.
Here dog's we go. Breath. It's Ricky Skaggs and Kentucky Thunder and Dog's Breath.
Two.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Samara Selden. So Samara, the way I like to close the show is with this question about self-care. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you do to take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, and physically throughout the day, weekly, monthly, yearly, and how do you know you need to do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think a lot of that has changed in the last couple of years for me. Last spring, I actually took a leave of absence from my job, and I went to Southeast Asia, spent a semester kind of exploring different forms of mind-body healing. Mm-hmm. And something that has stuck with me really strongly from that trip, and that is kind of absolutely how I deal with self-care now, is mm-hmm. I did a silent meditation retreat for about a week.
Oh, okay, and, yeah. A week is long enough. I mean, you can go for a month, but...
Yeah. Maybe one day. But that particular experience definitely shaped how I relate to myself a lot and how I deal with when points of conflict or points of discomfort arise in my own self. Mm-hmm. 'Cause one of the big things that we did there is you step back and you allow yourself to have whatever thoughts or feelings you have,
sure.
but you try to dissociate from them a little bit.
Right. They don't control you, but you observe them.
Right. And you remember that whatever story or whatever is running through your mind, that is your reality that you've created for yourself. And yet it's not the only truth.
It's not the only possible story.
Right.
It's
absolutely.
The one you have.
Right. So that is definitely something that at any point, in the last year, that's been something that's really, really carried strongly with me. And that, I mean, okay, I'm going all over the place here.
This is fine.
But in terms of kind of if I'm upset about something or I'm just, you know, feeling less than 100%, I do enjoy, you know, physical exercise or yoga or movement or some kind of physical outlet. But then I couple that with breathing and a reminder that there are other perspectives on whatever issue it is that I'm mm-hmm. thinking about. And I try to kind of step out of my own perspective and consider other possibilities and, you know, give space to allow myself to feel angry or upset or whatever it is, but then move away from that and mm-hmm. come back to it with a new kind of mind there.
Right. And the thing, well, you mentioned anger is a signal.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you need to kind of just stay with the signal long enough to see where it points.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. I think also I'm really lucky I live in a house with four really amazing roommates and we all are really close. And so we cook all the time together and we have a dog and we go on hikes and, you know, so we kind of have our own little family. That is a way that also I...
So emotionally you are re-energized by these relationships.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we all like have different hardships and struggles and yet we all can support each other mm-hmm. in different ways because of that. And so... that's another way that definitely helps me emotionally charge.
Right. And what's striking there is that you discovered that even having been an only child.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And you're living in a family style mm-hmm. environment.
Yeah.
What do you do? So and yoga we started out talking about this as being one of your jobs mm-hmm. is teaching yoga, but it's also one of the ways you self-care, I assume.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. For the physical part, but it's or what are the other things you do for physical self-care?
Yeah, I like to walk mm-hmm. and breathe. I think I even come back to this breathing thing, but it's huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's if you're feeling overwhelmed about something, it can be really hard to force yourself to take 10 deep breaths. But if I am overwhelmed about something and I force myself to take 10 deep breaths, my entire mindset shifts.
Right,
and because it's that same thing, you're changing it's physiologically changing what's going on in your body. I think when you take slow, deep breaths, you're calming yourself down and you allow yourself to maybe move into, I don't know if a more rational form of thinking, but it allows you to help see yourself differently and allows you to step back from whatever mindset you're locked into.
Right. Right.
And so,
right. So, and did you learn that have you had a meditation practice?
I had not. And actually I had distinctly not. I'd always thought that meditation would be an interesting thing to try. And yet part of the reason I forced myself to do the week-long meditation retreat is I had a friend who suggested it, and I felt this visceral reaction in my body. I was like, there's no way I would...
No way in hell I'm going there.
Exactly. That sounds terrible. And then as soon as I felt that, I said, oh, why am I reacting so strongly against this? This is something I have to do.
Right.
So I didn't, but now I do have... It's not as consistent as I would like. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'd love to get up and meditate every morning. So far, not there yet, but...
We'll go back to that, but I want to ask, when did you learn that I'm having a really strong reaction against something? This is where I need to go explore. When did you learn that?
Huh.
That's key.
Yeah. That, I think, is something I learned a long time ago.
In relation to your parents, or
I think that might come from my dad. I'm just thinking out loud here, it's something that he's in the way. He was the type of parent that I did pretty well in school.
Mm-hmm.
But he would one time I think I got a C on a test, and he was like, "Oh, congratulations, Sam! That's great. You know, it's good to learn to fail. It's good to mess up, or it's good to do things like that." And so I think something about that kind of, and not that specific, getting a C on a test, but that kind of mindset of, hey, like, if you don't do something how you expected, or something turns out differently, like, or you feel strongly against something, even if it, like, because a meditation retreat is hypothetically something that would be good for you. So if you're feeling so strongly against something that could positively benefit you, what's going on there?
Yeah. So, and this goes on, goes with the companion question that I often ask. When did you learn that it was your responsibility for your self-care? You couldn't rely on other people to take care of you, but you had to step up yourself.
Yeah.
And there's a process. It's not one one event, but it's over time. How have you learned to step up to take care of yourself?
Right. I think, again, this is recent. I think I've always known that for a long time. And that's something that my mom also has frequently told me, growing up. She's like, you're the only person that can make you feel a certain way. Like, you need to take care of yourself. And yet there's a difference between, again, intellectually understanding that and actually doing it.
Right.
And I'm the type of person that I like to take care of other people. Mm-hmm. You know, for a while, my friends jokingly would call me Samama, because I was the...
You have the name for it.
I got the name, so you can make a pun out of it. So it's kind of that I'm used to externally focusing my energies and making sure that everyone around me is taken care of. And that was a really big, beautiful part of my trip to Southeast Asia, and especially the meditation retreat really kicked that off, is realizing, hey, you have to take care of yourself and you have to love yourself. And there's actually this great quote that I think sums up, a friend told me. He said, heal yourself and you will be healing to be around.
Right.
And so that, I think, this is it's a pretty recent thing, but it's kind of, that's how I try to approach things now. And I try to remember, hey, take care of yourself and also everyone else, but you will be your best version of yourself if you take care of yourself and love yourself.
Right.
And yeah.
Right. And it kind of, the paradox about that is that life gives us wonder and damage.
Yeah.
And when we, so healing ourselves is really deciding how to deal with, how to take responsibility for what we didn't necessarily cause, but that we have to address.
Yeah.
You know, because nobody gets out without being broken.
Yeah.
Or in some sense hurt or roughed up.
Yeah.
And it's really beautiful to see a person then take it upon themselves to do that.
Yeah.
Samara, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
You wanted to close with a song. Do you want to say anything about it, or just play it, or how do you want to close this out?
Sure. This is a Gambian artist that I heard, I think when I was traveling, I heard her playing at a cafe once, and I loved the song so much that I went over to the counter and said, who is this? And I wrote her name down. I love music, so I like, collecting different types of artists, but she's incredible. She's a Gambian kora player. She plays this, I think it's like a 12-string instrument, and she has a beautiful voice. Sona Jabarta.
Here we go. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.